Welcome to Planning Unplugged, a podcast series from planning lawyers at Womble Bond Dickinson. We operate in an ever-changing world of law and policy, so we're here to provide you with the latest insight and a point of view like no other.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Planning Unplugged. I'm James Clark and I'm joined today by my colleague Sarah White. Hi Sarah, would you like to introduce yourself?
Thanks James. So I'm a legal director in the London office and I've been with WBD for about 2.5 years now. And before that, I was in local government for many years. I currently manage the planning team in the London office and this is my first podcast. So absolutely great to be with you today. We are going to be discussing a subject that's really important to me and something I'm really passionate about, but I'll hand over to you to give more details around that.
Great to have you with us. So the 8th of March was International Women's Day and March is Women's History Month. So to mark those events, we're hosting a special edition of Planning Unplugged, focusing on women and planning. And we're delighted to be joined by Dr. Karen Horwood and Jenna Dutton. And particular congratulations to Karen for being recognised in the Planner Magazine's Women of Influence 2024. Welcome to you both.
Hi, and thank you.
Hi.
Karen, Jenna, it'd be great if you could introduce yourselves to our listeners. Karen, if you go first, and we'll then go to Jenna.
Hi, so my name's Dr. Karen Horwood. I'm a senior lecturer at Leeds Beckett University in the Leeds Planning School there. My area of interest is women and planning. So I do research around considering how we do and don't consider the needs of women and girls when planning our towns and cities. I'm also the gender mainstreaming lead for Women in Planning. I also convened a conference in 2019 called Women and Planning, which, as it says on the tin, was about women and planning, and brought together practitioners and academics to discuss that. And I'm also convening in 2024, in July 2024, I'm convening 5 years later our next Women and Planning conference, which is thinking about how we take some of those ideas from theory into practice. So again, engaging academics and practitioners in thinking about how the ongoing discussion we're having around women and planning can start to be applied in a more practical context.
Hi everyone, I'm Jenna Dutton. I'm currently a doctoral researcher at the University of the West of England, Bristol, in the Sustainable Planning and Environments group, where my topic is focused on gender inequality in cities and urban planning. I'm also the co-chair of the Commonwealth Women in Planning Network, and I've worked in planning professionally for the past 14 years in mostly in Canada in policy development and social planning. I do quite a bit of research, some of which is with Karen as well, on feminist planning and urbanism and how gender inequality is connected to things like aging and various other aspects in cities.
Thanks very much, both. So in your view, how does the planning system currently fail women and girls? Karen, we'll go to you first to start the discussion.
Sure. So I think in order to understand how the planning system currently fails women and girls, we need to think about the history of that planning system as well. So if we go back to the inception of planning and we kind of think about, you know, the images that we might see or the ways that we might talk about what planning was, it was very much about what I kind of describe as men with maps and models, where it's sort of important men with their kind of pointy sticks that are pointing at these big models with very much a bird's eye view of the places that they were planning. And that's kind of the legacy that planning now has, that's, you know, what planning was when it first started. So the people that were in the room were generally speaking white men, because of course, in any profession at that point in time, it was mainly white men that were in the room. So if you've got a limited group of people within the room, they're going to be looking at the decisions that they're making through a particular lens that doesn't include the needs of everyone. So as a result, there was a lot of planning activity that was undertaken that didn't really consider everyone's needs. It just thought about the needs of the people who were in the room. That's not to say it's some big conspiracy of, you know, wanting to leave women and girls out. That was the historical context in which planning was operating, where women weren't in many professions at all, let alone being in planning as well. So then there started to be some criticism of that, both in academia and in practice, and more women entering into the profession, which meant that we started to have more conversations about the ways in which the planning system was failing women and girls. So there's lots of, obviously in that period of time, there's been lots of change and there's been lots of kind of more conversation about the needs of women and girls and more discussion of how we might begin to change things. There, sort of going back to the early 2000s, there was a move to consider something called gender mainstreaming more, which is where we look at decision-making through a gendered lens. So the planning system is kind of trying to catch up with that legacy of having not considered everyone's needs to thinking about how we can better consider those needs.
Jenna?
Yeah, I mean, I echo what Karen just said, not to steal her answer, but obviously agree. But also, I guess, in terms of more recent attempt of like implementation of gender inclusion in the planning system, I would say in Canada and North America, like where most of my experience was, as well as the UK, the tendency has been, even when gender inequality has been acknowledged through increased data that has been gender disaggregated and everything, there's a tendency to put gender or the need for consideration of the needs of like women and girls within like broader equality considerations. So it doesn't actually get prioritized. So an example of this is things like doing very small steps to attempt to be gender inclusive, which can address some things, but for instance, typically are things like increased lighting, which doesn't really solve the broader issues. So yeah, I think just relating to the RTPI gender mainstreaming toolkit that Karen mentioned, there hasn't been a lot of capacity at a local government level to implement it, which is, again, not a purposeful thing. It's just the planning system as it is. And also just the value isn't overly understood. So it needs to be kind of integrated into the planning education as well.
Thanks, Jenna. So with that in mind, I wonder, are there any aspects of planning policy that are or can be more gender inclusive, even if gender isn't specifically mentioned? Starting with yourself, Jenna, what do you think on that? What are your thoughts?
Yes, definitely. I mean, that's the focus mainly of my PhD topic. So it's something I'm very passionate about. But I would say there's kind of connecting to my previous response, there's a tendency to think about, okay, what is gender inclusion in cities? So it's not just things like having pink picnic benches everywhere and things like that to make cities better for women. So it highlighted in, there was a recent ARUP, UNDP, University of Liverpool report that came out last year about cities designed for women. And one of the concluding sentences was cities that are designed to be more gender inclusive are more sustainable for everyone. That's proven fact by lots and lots of research. So I think policy exists at various levels that is gender inclusive, even if it isn't defined as such. So thinking about sustainable policy, so how climate change affects women and girls disproportionately more than men. And then also thinking about policy in that might not be directly thought of as being more women specific. So things, if you're thinking about active transportation, bike lanes that are designed to be more like cycle tracks, so they're separated from the road with a physical barrier, are proven to be more used by women. So, and then also the design of sort of bus and transit times to think about the way women move around the city, which is proven to be kind of more short-term trips than how the transit system has been designed. And then things like care work and childcare and how those haven't really been necessarily always considered in the planning system. So really gender inclusion or thinking about gender inequality is kind of these sort of cross-cutting systemic approach. So thinking beyond silos. So how have women not been thought about in different aspects of the city, not just sort of like design or transportation, but all of these things.
And Karen, any thoughts from you on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd second what Jenna eloquently said of how policy can more broadly be gender sensitive. I think kind of coming at it from a like almost the opposite perspective, I did a piece of research where I looked at local plans in order to see whether gender is mentioned specifically. And I didn't just look for gender, I looked for female, women, sex, gender, inequality, inequalities, various permutations of those words to see if local plans were talking about women at all, particularly given the context of the Equalities Act, which does give a public sector equalities duty to consider equalities in policymaking. And the results were that it was very unusual for local plans to use any of those terms. Where they were using those terms, it tended to be talking about kind of, it might talk about life expectancy, and so it might talk about life expectancy for women and men being different, or those kind of general statistical considerations. And what I found particularly interesting was that, you know, given that the existence of the Equalities Act, that there were a proportion of local plans that didn't mention equalities at all, which is quite an interesting observation that actually they could not use those words at all in the entire plan. But kind of on the flip side from that, there were some that used the word equality or equalities a lot, but that didn't really indicate that they were actually then doing anything meaningful in relation to gender inclusivity. Because what then tended to happen was they would then just be signalling commitment to the Equalities Act, but without any substance. So it would be statements where they'd say, we support the Equalities Act, but there was no kind of so what of, well, what do you do to support the Equalities Act? And turning a little bit to an academic context, there is some kind of research about how a concept of something called non-performativity. I don't want to go too academic on the discussion, but there is this idea of non-performativity where if you keep signalling your commitment to a particular thing, that can actually mean you don't do anything at all, because the action that is being carried out is to just signal your support. Therefore, you don't do anything, which is almost a worse situation to be in. So what we did find in a lot of the local plans was there was this signalling, but then a lack of actual action.
So just on that point, I wonder if we could just have a think actually about whether the issue is around a lack of expertise in local government when they're progressing the plan in relation to equalities matters, or whether it comes back to sort of resource issues really in terms of the funding constraints around them at the moment. Just wonder, Karen, have you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think in my experience, it's both of those things. I've had lots of conversations with practitioners to try and find out what is going on. You know, I teach planning, people working in planning or people wanting to work in planning. And, you know, I talk to them about these things as well. And usually people are interested and people care and people want to do something about it. But, you know, as you say, the resources are really limited. They're sat in a planning office with lots and lots of different demands on their time and different things they're trying to juggle. So it's finding a way of this being something that you can, you know, you can add in. Without it being, one of the things with gender mainstreaming is to see it as something that can run through everything people are doing rather than it being an extra task that needs doing. And there are some instances where local authorities are doing work in this area, and it, you know, it tends to come down to a particular individual that is particularly interested and wants to do that work, and you know, they're kind of finding their way through that, but, you know, with those same difficulties. And coming back to that point of expertise, that in the instances that I know of where people are doing some work, it will come down to the fact that they, so for one of them, his planning course at his university, he became interested in women and planning and did his dissertation on the subject. And so he's then brought that expertise to his workplace, which harks back to the comment Jenna made earlier on about the importance of planning education and actually talking about these things in our planning schools, which we are doing. We do lots and lots of at Leeds Beckett. I know other universities are doing the same. I was talking to a colleague from another university earlier in the week, and he was saying that women and planning is now one of the big subjects that planning students want to write their dissertations on, which is fantastic to see, because that then means that the expertise will start to come through.
So building on that then, how do we go about tackling the issues and what are the solutions? Jenna, shall we start with you?
Sure. A big question. There's many examples of success that's occurred across Europe mostly, but I guess the token sort of feminist city is always referred to as Vienna. But their work isn't new whatsoever. So they've been integrating gender inclusion into their planning system since the early 90s. And I think that there's various aspects of how they've integrated in terms of what I was talking about in transportation, the planning system design. But I think the key point there is that at sort of all levels of their leadership and in local government, they prioritized the need for gender inclusion, and they created a separate department to require sort of gender inclusive practices to be part of their development system, versus kind of to what Karen was saying, kind of making it an additional task. It's more has been integrated, and they've been very successful with that. I mean, there's critique of Vienna as well, that it's sort of like too pristine, perhaps too gender inclusive. So I would say also, I don't think there isn't a perfectly gender inclusive city, but I think the point is to improve it. Another example would be Barcelona as well. So a lot of people might be aware of their super block approach that came in with their new female mayor, or new as of 2015. But the focus that they've had on decreasing automobile use, so having more public spaces and considering women and girls, a lot of that was because they prioritized the actual like consultation, public engagement to be with women, girls, and elderly women from the inception. And I think having worked in planning, that is a huge win in terms of gender inequality in the planning system, is kind of what the gender mainstreaming toolkit says, is focusing on it from the beginning. So the design of the engagement and consultation approach and how women are able to be part of it. So it's not just, as I said, like the pink bench on the side of the street, but it's actually thinking about how women might not be included into those kind of participatory approaches that are used a lot for planning. There are many more examples. So I mentioned sort of the document that was made by AIRUP about designing cities for women, my apologies. But there's also so many different resources at international development levels. So Cities Alliance has a lot of toolkits, as well as UN Habitat and UN Women brought one out a couple years ago called Her City, which is more focused on girls. But these tools and these resources exist. So it's more just about kind of how to integrate them. Yeah, so the information is definitely not lacking.
Thanks, Jenna. Perhaps we can put some of those examples in the notes to the podcast so others can inform themselves.
So how do we encourage allyship, particularly from men? Karen, have you encountered good examples of this?
Yeah, so it's an interesting one, because if we're wanting to make change, you know, it's kind of a couple of things in that the people who have the power need to be helping make that change, because otherwise change isn't going to happen. And, you know, we are still in a situation where the leadership positions within planning are dominated by men. And also it kind of matters for, you know, reasons of being, you know, being fair and being just and, you know, kind of standing up and doing the right thing. As I said, when I was talking earlier about the example, there is someone that is doing a lot of work in his local authority, as I said, who was interested in the subject from doing his degree and is then kind of trying to lead the way in his local authority. And connecting back to some research that I've done, again, there's a paper that we had organized a conference in 2019, a women and planning conference in 2019 for academics and practitioners. And we had a series of papers come together from that conference, written by both academics and practitioners, that both engaged with the idea of, you know, how do we ensure the representation of women, kind of conceptualizing that through different types of representation, be that something called descriptive representation, which is having women in the room and having women in positions of power. So making sure that there are women in leadership positions within planning really matters, because it matters for reasons of justice and fairness and equalities. And that's what we would call descriptive representation. You know, things like having quotas for boards or having us, you know, 50% female MPs, things like that, they come under that umbrella. But the kind of academic perspective on it also highlights the idea of something called substantive representation, which is more the idea that rather than it just being women in the room, that actually women's needs are being heard and are being considered, and action is taking place to make sure that they are being included in any activity. And that's what we would call more substantive representation. And, you know, the literature talks about how that doesn't need to just come from women themselves. And indeed, it shouldn't just come from women themselves, because, you know, it shouldn't be beholden on the people that are the experiencing the problem to have to fix the problem. So there's a need for everyone to be involved in fixing that. And so therefore, you know, actions can come from different groups of people. So men can be allies and can be active in making sure that the needs of women and girls are considered. But there's then that difficulty, isn't there, of kind of taking over and thinking they know what's best, and therefore they're going to fix all the problems. So I think in that context, it's about having women in the room and making sure that those women are listened to and that they are able to speak and advocate for the needs of women and girls. Because often what can happen is that, you know, women can enter that space, but in order to enter that space, they have to behave in certain ways that aren't necessarily the ways that they might want to behave. They might have to choose their words carefully, not kind of rock the boat too much, you know, not be perceived as being angry or perceived as being confrontational. You know, they have to kind of modify what they say. And actually, women ought to be able to be listened to, engaging with the subject in, you know, in the way that they need to engage with it, and be listened to and be heard, and create cultures where that will happen, rather than just kind of, you know, expecting, oh, hey, here we are, we've got one woman in the room, she can advocate for everyone, let's kind of listen to her for 5 minutes and then get on back to normal business. It's about shifting culture so that, you know, women's voices are genuinely listened to and genuinely heard. And I think that's where there, you know, there's space for that allyship as well, is in creating those cultures and, you know, making sure that, you know, you don't talk over women and that you don't talk for women and that you make sure that you are genuinely listening to what they say. We do, in some of my teaching, we have a conversation about exactly this, about how we actively listen. And listening isn't just being quiet for a moment while someone speaks. It's about actually hearing what they're saying and actually responding to what they're saying and considering what they're saying. So I think that's kind of where one of the key moments of allyship can happen.
Picking up the point that Sarah mentioned earlier, the current issues with the planning system are well known. Under-resourced local planning authorities, overworked planning officers, and many out-of-date development plans. Given the problems facing the system, is there the bandwidth to implement any of these solutions? Karen, what's your view on this?
Yeah, and it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because we know that local authorities are under-resourced. We know that planning officers are overworked. You know, we know what a difficult position they're in. And as I say, I see that on the front line through the students that I teach that are experiencing all of those problems. I mean, I think one of the key things is relating back to something Jenna was talking about earlier about how this intersects with other issues. You know, if places are more gender inclusive, they will also be more sustainable. So if we're trying to advocate for sustainable places, we can, you know, add this in as well. But rather than it being, you know, a bolt-on, an additional bolt-on, think about how it can be mainstreamed within things that are happening already. Also, I think it's important to recognise that we don't want to limit our thinking due to the current economic and political situation. So we still need to be having the conversations about what we might want to happen in a more aspirational way, albeit recognising that that might not be the point that we're at the moment. But I sort of hate the thought of stifling our thinking, of sort of limiting our thinking to just what can be achieved at this precise moment, at this precise time, because that then makes us very kind of unaspirational. And when you think of the kind of history of planning within those kind of utopian roots of imagining a better world, imagining a better place, we need to be able to continue doing that, even if the context we're operating in might limit what we can actually do. And I think the other thing to consider is that it's not about being perfect. It's not about doing everything all at once. It's about thinking about what the little actions that we can do are that can lead us to that future goal. Rather than seeing the future goal as this big, massive thing that we can do all or nothing, we can actually do little bits to work towards that goal. And it's worth doing those things rather than thinking, well, you know, what can I do? What can I really change in with the limited resources available to me? Well, by doing one little thing, that may well build into bigger things, and that may spiral, and other people may hear about that little thing, and actually that might mushroom into something much bigger. So doing the little things matter as well as trying to do the big thing further down the road.
Yeah, it sounds really important to me, as you say, to do those small steps and things that we can achieve in the shorter term, but while still trying to achieve those larger milestones in the future. So that's really important. I think that pretty much wraps up where we are today. And personally, from my perspective, I found the discussion really interesting. I know we've spoken before and it's been just so insightful hearing what you've both got to say on the subject, and certainly makes you think about how we can try to make things better for the future. So thank you so much for joining us today. We do always like to conclude the podcast with three takeaway points. So, Karen, I'll start with you. What's the first takeaway point that you'd like our listeners to take away?
So I think the takeaway home point for me relates to what we were just talking about, that we can all do little actions with what is available to us. And that's how change is going to happen, is if we all do the things that we can do. I was just finding a quote that often gets talked about in this context of never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, that is the only thing that ever has. So if we all do little things, that's what creates the big change. We don't need to wait for that big change.
Definitely a very important point. Jenna, how about you? Have you got a second takeaway point for our listeners?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if I have it worded super eloquently in my head yet, but I think there's an aspect to which International Women's Day is lovely, but when International Women's Day is every day, women make up more than half the people on the planet. And I think, well, I know that kind of connects to similarly kind of what Karen was saying about it's not just a small step. It's not just kind of one day a year. It's not just like a micro pilot gender inclusive approach. So it's thinking about gender inclusion and its impact as kind of a system, but then also thinking of kind of what is scalable and what can be done. And sorry, I know this is supposed to be a short takeaway, but I just want to mention also that I think gender inclusion needs to be intersectional. A lot of the International Women's Day stuff is still very much focused on kind of this white upper class sort of feminist approach. And I think it's very important to think about how women in cities are also women of color, disabled women, women who are neurodivergent, and anything and all in between. So thinking about how all women are impacted by not being considered in city planning.
I'll conclude with a third takeaway point then. As Karen mentioned earlier, the Women and Planning Conference is being held on the 1st and 2nd of July. And for those that are interested in exploring this topic further, I'd really recommend following Jenna and Karen on LinkedIn, and you'll be able to obtain further details of the conference there. Well, I thought that was a really fascinating discussion with Karen and Jenna. Really interesting to hear their perspectives, and also from a slightly more academic rather than a legal perspective. And I think it just sort of shows the value really of bringing together people from all disciplines to look at this issue more holistically. Sarah, I know that you've held events where you've brought together lots of different people under the sort of subject matter of women and planning. And I just wondered if you'd like to sort of reflect on the experiences that you've had.
Yes, we held an
event in the London office back in December, which was the Women in Planning Christmas get together. And it was really, really interesting actually to see how well attended the event was. I think we had a waiting list, which is always a good sign, but also just in terms of the attendees. And there were a number of men that joined us, and it was really interesting to hear their side of things and why they'd come along and the importance of them getting to know more about the organisation and what we do. So it was a real success and absolutely a really inspiring event.
I think that's really interesting. I think it's really pleasing to see that men are attending those events. I think that sometimes, I suppose, just speaking for myself, your worry is that very often the space for women to talk about issues and raise issues are quite limited as it is. And you think, oh, is it my place to come along? Am I sort of crowding out voices or you know, like you say, space was limited. Does it mean that a woman that would have wanted to go along to it isn't able to go because I've taken the space? But I suppose, as you're saying, it's really important to have a range of people and a range of views in the room in order to sort of move the discussion on.
Yeah, and I think it's really important. Karen mentioned earlier in the podcast that by inviting and encouraging men to come along to these events and hearing what women have got to say about their experiences, the hope is that when we do end up getting in the room and have the ability to influence the planning system, that we're not just there, but we are listened to, and that it has an impact. And I think that's really important. And so having those ambassadors coming along to events like Women in Planning and the conference is really, really important, and really encourage men to attend where they can.
I think that was one of the points I think that sort of impacted me the most from the discussion, which is really about the need to build this into the planning system at all levels. It's not something that can be sort of like fitted in at the last stage of a local plan making process and just sort of say, have you looked at how this will affect women? It has to be embedded within the entire system. And as you say, one of the ways of doing that is making sure that there's an awareness at all levels. It's not just a single officer that has the responsibility of ensuring that women's voice is heard in the system.
I agree with that, but I think just drawing upon some of my local government experience, I think education is going to be a really key point, so that new planners coming through the system, it will just be embedded into their day-to-day work, as opposed to, I think it was Karen that mentioned, there is a need at the moment where some local authorities are better than others because they have particular expertise. I think at the moment, given all of the other pressures on local government in terms of resourcing and all of the things we've already talked about, there isn't going to be many opportunities, in my view, for officers to take additional time out to get that expertise. So I think we are very much reliant on that educational piece coming through, and groups like we've talked about, to really help to help with the understanding around the subject.
Thanks, Sarah. And thanks very much in particular to Jenna and to Karen for joining us and giving up their time for this episode. That's all from us. We'll see you next time. Thanks.